Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to fling your favorite fishing rod around. And here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance covers your boat and your belongings. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to high-five someone. But not while you're holding your fishing rod. That's a prized possession. So hold on tight with both hands and keep it covered through boat insurance. Get more with GEICO.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Coven.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast. My name is Dr. Mark McNear, and I will be your guest host today. I'm filling in for my good friend, Monique Coven, and today I am honored to have with me Benjamin Fry. Benjamin is an author, a psychotherapist, a couples counselor, a speaker. He is an entrepreneur, and he is also known for founding the Chiron Clinics, and we're going to talk about that probably at the end of the broadcast. But right now, I just want to welcome you to the Healing Trauma Podcast, Benjamin.
Thank you so much. Good to be here, Mark.
I wanted to start out, and I got permission from you beforehand, but I'm going to ask you if you would share your story with the listeners, the journey that you have been through in regard to...
I mean, that's an opening to a very long and in some places probably not very interesting story about everything, but I'm specifically interested in kind of my own symptoms and degeneration into what we might call a nervous breakdown. I can talk about that maybe in a more focused way and tell you where I think, where that originated in. But that was part of the journey to discover that it did. I had in, I think it was 2008, I began to have what I think colloquially we would call the beginning of a nervous breakdown. So I had a young family, had different business interests. 2008, there was a financial crash, which particularly impacted some sectors worse than others, which I was invested in. And I think that there were real world concerns like there were for many people. But in retrospect, what I notice is that my emotional, cognitive, but more importantly, my physiological reaction to stress and anxiety and difficulty was wildly exaggerated from what I would expect it to be today or what the situation really merited, and also significantly what was actually useful and what was effective. So I just became terminally anxious, worried. I started to have trouble sleeping, and then I had more and more trouble sleeping, and I slept terribly badly for many months. And then I couldn't work anymore because I really couldn't function. And I ended up at the tail end of all of this, just unable to do anything. I had young children. I couldn't play with them. I couldn't laugh. I couldn't relate, connect to my then wife. I couldn't work. I couldn't provide. I couldn't do anything at all. It was a total disaster. I couldn't solve problems. So, as the father of the house, I was less functional than the infant of the house. Eventually, I think the suffering was so long and intense that it gave way to suicidal thinking. Not really because, I guess there are many reasons to feel suicidal, but in my case, it was really that it seemed like a way to just get a break from the suffering. So I've heard it said that it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And, looking back on it now, obviously that's true. So what I noticed, though, which was concerning, because I was a trained psychotherapist, I've been through, suicidal ideation 101 class.
Yeah.
And like many things which help us regulate, like alcohol or anything, it's a sort of escalating ladder. So at the beginning, it's kind of comforting to think there might be a way out one day, maybe, as an esoteric abstract idea. And then, of course, the more that becomes a thing, it comforts you, the more you have to escalate the thinking. And I got to a point where I started to think about how rather than if or what. And I knew it was like a parallel part of my brain kicked in, which was watching, which said, hang on, I've seen this in a class somewhere. This is not good. So I kind of pressed the panic button and got myself admitted to London's most fancy, famous psychiatric hospital, which was supposed to be able to cure all celebrities of any ills, if you've read the newspapers for the last 30 years in London. And really, I think that's when I arrived there and when I was admitted and when I spent time with the medical director, that's when I actually started to get scared. Because I realized that safety blanket that I assumed was there was just smoke and mirrors. It was emperor's new clothes. There was nothing there. There were beds, there were nurses, there were drugs, there were doctors. But being a semi-functional psychotherapist at some point in my life, I knew that story was also important and that people had a richer life than just their neurotransmitters. And it seemed sort of reductionist, almost the point of absurdity. And the population didn't seem to be doing that well. People would sit around in groups talking about the one thing that I'd come there to avoid thinking about. I don't know. I mean, maybe I was just a poor fit for the right solution, but I left after a week, having started on a course of antidepressants. Eventually dropped my antidepressants because they were so overwhelming, I couldn't stand the side effects. 6 months later, I was back to square one. And this time I pulled the emergency cord and went to a facility in Arizona, primarily because someone said, I think you have trauma. And they advertised themselves as working with trauma. I went there in terrible shape. I was admitted to the kind of, you know, nurse's station bit, kind of medicalized part. Mm-hmm. The place is basically a large rehab that also treats trauma and also does more expansive medical work on like detox. And in my case, just kind of tried to stabilize me. And to be fair to them, they did. I mean, I worked with a psychiatric nurse who was much more attentive than the medical director of a big hospital. And she really listened to the fact that I found in my state of incredible anxiety, introducing chemicals into my body gave my body signals of something new and different and weird, which just spiked my anxiety. So she was just took it very slow and low, literally onto a low dose of antidepressants. And after 3 or 4 weeks of that, I actually started to sleep again.
Okay.
And then I, by chance, in the patient's lounge, bumped into a lady who ran an aftercare unit at the same facility, which I had not been pointed to, but turned out I desperately needed. This is, you know, this is how new it all was in 2009, 2010. No one really knew what was going on. And she was somebody who would work in a residential setting, like aftercare residential, with trauma as a kind of primary problem rather than as an idea behind all your other problems. And so we did EMDR and somatic experiencing and some other things and group work in a community. And I was there for 3 or 4 months, and it basically saved my life. I got in and under what had been driving my symptoms. I got into it, through it enough to diminish those symptoms to be able to go back to daily life. I'd been out there for 5 months before I got back to my family, my young kids, which obviously had been a big anxiety all along. You worry about these things, and everyone was always saying, best thing you can do for your kids is stay here, get well, etc. They couldn't have been more right, but of course, nonetheless, there's damage. I had a 2-year-old daughter who came home from school. The teacher said, I need to talk to the mother. And she said, we're worried about her because she was telling kids in the playground that her father's dead.
Okay.
So there was a lot of collateral damage. Anyway, I'm still alive. She's now 18. We have a really great relationship. We speak about things like her problems with boyfriends and the amount of money she needs to go out for dinner with friends. It's, you know, just normal dad stuff. So
yeah, good stuff, right?
Right. So that's normal. And the flip side of it is that if you understand kind of attachment and trauma, you can see in her interactions with, you know, as teenagers learn to be out in the dating pool, that these things leave a mark.
Yeah.
And you can see like the attachment system of someone who, when they were very young, missed something that they needed, this shows up. So there's a kind of rich tapestry here, I think, of recovery and then recovery from recovery. If you want, I can talk about what the trauma was underlying all of this.
Sure.
Another layer to the story, and I'm taking up a lot of your time already.
No. I want to invite you to talk about it. And I'm curious, Benjamin, before that, if I could ask you, when people started talking about trauma with you, what was that like for you? How was that conceptualized in your mind?
It's a very good question. I think what happened, because the context of this facility I was in was a large rehab, that they had adapted from a kind of 12-step model to being more understanding about people's narratives and history. So they just correlated what looked like something you could call trauma with people ending up there. And so there was an interest in that and a kind of fascination on campus. And then there was a collaboration with Peter Levine and Francine Shapiro, who I think the shift was, they used to say trauma causes addiction, so that's it, you're stuck with it, now deal with the addiction.
And then they
added in this idea, what if you could actually reduce the trauma, heal the trauma, do something about your trauma? I wasn't really an addict or in any kind of addiction, but I really needed to heal my traumas. It's a really good question, what is trauma? We could maybe get into that later. I've got things to say. But at that time, it was really just like anything that happened to you as a kid that was less than nurturing could be labeled trauma.
Okay.
And so it was in the story, it was in the narrative. Now, you know, there's so much more to say about where it sits, like in the body rather than in the story. Maybe we'll get into that.
Yeah, let's back up for a minute and let's go to when you talk about trauma in your own story, what that looked like for you and what you've been able to explore.
So, you know, reasonably depressingly straightforward stuff. My mother, I was the first child of my parents. When I was 4 months old, my mother took some antibiotics, which caused her to get aplastic anemia, which was a fatal blood disease. So she died when I was 11 months old. You know, I'm born, I hang around with some freaked out young parents watching my mother die. She dies. I go to live with her best friend in the countryside because my father's commuting to work. God knows, you know, I recovered some memories in EMDR, actually. And I think what was going on is that I thought I'd just been sent to another house. I didn't really understand that my mother didn't exist anymore. And that my father would visit at weekends and then he would leave without taking me home with him. And so, you know, this constant freak out. And what I was told is that after my mother died, I was in America. She was American. I came back to England to live with this family and I wouldn't eat. I just refused to eat. So, you know, that's the state I was in at 1 year old. Then eventually my father actually, before he remarried, he got together with my stepmother and they formed a household, and then I moved there. So that was just before I was about three. So by the time I was three, I'd had three mothers in three different houses. And you probably know that people say, well, you know, if everything's okay up to three, you're probably going to make it. Everything was a shit show for three. Yeah. And then, you know, by any standards, I had a pretty privileged life. So this is the difficult dichotomy. I mean, I was a pretty good student. Privileged in one sense, I went to boarding school at eight. For 10 years, which these days people might think was peculiar. But look, I had a really good education. My relationship with my stepmother wasn't great. So, you know, to be off at school with my friends, I think for me, it wasn't the end of the world. I think the damage was done by the time I was three. I think if I'd stayed at home instead of going to boarding school, I might have actually had a worse childhood in my case. So, you know, I was lucky. I went to really good schools. Then I got into Oxford University, studied at Oxford, and ostensibly had everything anyone could want in life. And the activity in my family of origin transferred to a kind of taboo about my mother. Because I'd been so young, I was raised with my stepmother as my mother, and then she had two children. And we were just a nuclear family of five. That was the deal. And there were sort of peculiarities around the periphery of this, like I had three grandmothers. How does that happen? Yeah. But it became, I mean, I could be making this up, but it felt to me like it was hugely taboo. And I have had that validated by other people who were like her friends, my grandmother. You know, later in life, I got into the questions about it. And, you know, who knows? They may be making it up too, but I don't think so. I think it just was a kind of choice. Let's move on. Very British way of dealing with grief. I mean, it was a very sad situation. My mother was 25 when she died. My father was 30. They'd been together 5 years. They just had a baby. I couldn't imagine what I would do in that situation. I couldn't tell you I'd do anything better or worse. I don't judge it. But that is what happens. I don't know. You know, put all of that into the mixing bowl. And then I was 38, 39. I have four young children and a pregnant wife. And financially, things are falling apart. And so on the surface, you know, I'm like this privileged kid who went to boarding school in Oxford, who should be able to do anything he wants. And yet what's really going on is like, it's a castle built on sand. And those first 3 years are like the worst possible foundation. So any, you know, a breath of wind and the whole thing just collapsed, which I didn't know. I didn't understand that. I just, you know, just layers upon layers of problems and guilt and shame and self-judgment. And so in the desert, in this facility, I kind of, you know, I kind of went there, died and was reborn, actually. Very biblical kind of story. And I felt like I came back to England. I had nothing other than myself. I mean, I was completely broke. I was unemployable, was unemployed. And I had these children and wife and, you know, responsibilities. And now what? I was better. I wasn't well, but I was walking wounded well, which was a totally different ballgame to where I'd been. Long story short, what I did, because I have a history of entrepreneurial activity, I was given a glimpse of an opportunity to start a clinic. And I took it and ran. It was kind of crazy looking back on it. We didn't really have the resources we needed. Any normal person would have said, don't do that. Seems like a bad idea. But I did it, and it's still going 13 and a half years later. And of course, you know, it's weathered many storms, and it's grown. It's grown in terms of not just its capacity, but in terms of what we understand and how we do it and who we can help and the ways that we help. At the beginning, I copied what I'd been treated by, almost carbon copy, literally. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, you know, that was my goal. It was just, I had to go all the way to Arizona. That flight was probably one of the worst experiences of my life. The thought of just being able to do it around the corner appealed. And I thought it would have appeal to others. So I thought I'd try it. And it did. But there's so many things that we didn't know then that we know now. I think the polyvagal theory is a big pillar of what we do.
Yes. Yeah.
I'd never heard of IFS, Dick Schwartz, internal family systems. Mm-hmm. Sensory motor psychotherapy was something we were introduced to, which is kind of a cousin of somatic experiencing. Neurofeedback, Bessel van der Kolk has helped me understand a lot about that. I've been lucky in that I've met a lot of the pioneers in our field as well. And, you know, developed relationships with them because they've been very generous in their desire to help. I think people who are active in this area, they talk a lot, they write a lot. And it's really interesting to them how the work that they either teach or imply is implemented at the coalface, particularly with the most difficult patients, which is kind of where we sit in residential treatment. So we've had a lot of help, a lot of advice, for which I'm really grateful. It's been a great journey. I've stayed in treatment. I continue to do somatic therapy every week. And
I just want to say, Benjamin, I'm really glad you brought that up, because as a trauma survivor myself, I stay in treatment. And there is a lot, and I've talked with Monique about this, there's a lot of people incorrectly that are posing trauma as something that, you know, can be fixed. And for me, and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it, it's an ongoing process. You know, you use the phrase that trauma marks you, and it does mark you, you know, and it's in your body. And I think that it needs ongoing care. Your thoughts on that?
What? Could your daily routine be full of hormone disruptors? There are more than 1,000 hormone disruptors living in our environment right now, in our food, our water, the air we breathe, the clothes we wear, our skincare, and they all mess with our hormones. Then there's the natural hormonal changes our bodies go through, perimenopause, menopause, and while it's a natural process, it doesn't mean we don't suffer through it. The good news is that we don't have to suffer through any of it anymore, because now we have Hormone Harmony, a formula made only with herbal ingredients that are shown to reduce hormonal symptoms in women of all ages. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal ingredients called adaptogens. Now here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. That's why Hormone Harmony is perfect for women of all ages who are struggling with life-disrupting symptoms such as PMS-like irritability, moodiness, discomfort, or uncontrollable cravings, menopause symptoms such as hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts, low moods, poor sleep, and feeling tired all the time, occasional bloating and gas. Yes, Hormone Harmony can help with all of these things. Hormone Harmony is not just a hormone-supporting supplement. It's become a phenomenon. Women cannot stop talking about it on social media. A bottle of Hormone Harmony is sold every 24 seconds. And the biggest benefit? Feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over in their reviews. And there are more than 30,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code HEALING at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code HEALING for 15% off today.
Owning a boat comes with a number of perks, like being able to say, ahoy, or land ho, and not feel weird about it. So here's another perk. GEICO's boat insurance offers access to the largest towing fleet on the water. And with specialist support from agents that are as passionate about boating as you are, there's so much value that you'll want to say, shiver me timbers, and not feel weird about that either. Get more with GEICO.
Well, firstly, I would just caution about using the word trauma to mean one thing. So sometimes you can, here's the goal in a sense. Like if you talk to someone, and Bessel van der Kolk has a great video of this. Here's a woman who talks about a car crash. And you can see in the first video when she talks about the car crash, she's in the car crash. The physiology, yeah. The speech pattern, everything is like she's right there. She's reliving it while talking about it. She goes on a course of EMDR, talks about the car crash again. She's narrating a memory this time. So, you know, the memory will never be gone. And the consequences of whatever happened, which may be other than psychological, will remain there. I mean, the car still crashed, right? But that's what we might call a single incident adult trauma. And something like EMDR can do a huge amount to make that complete what the mammal wants to complete. So let me just take a small sidebar. I would define trauma as an incomplete response to an earlier threat. And what I mean is that the body has various gears it goes through in response to threat. I mean, you can fight, flight, freeze, or before that, hypervigilance, or even before that, social engagement. You know, we'll try and make friends with people so things don't escalate. And you come into that process and come out of that process in the wild. If you were around a predator and you survive, mm-hmm. You know, a gazelle, for example, will escalate and then de-escalate and then they're done. Now, if you go into freeze, you know, if you interrupt that process because of overwhelm, then in order to recover from it, you have to restart the process to finish it. And you know, if you know somatic therapies, you'll know that people talk about completing things, processing things, and that's what mm-hmm. they're looking for. And I did a lot of that myself in EMDR and somatic experiencing and other modalities. You know, to answer your question, like, can you heal trauma? You can probably complete the reaction to a car crash. And like 90-something% it's done, and maybe even 100%, because the biology is complete, the body is complete, the memory's there, but it sat upon an adult architecture that was in good shape in the first place. It disturbed the physiology. You complete the physiology, you're done. Now, take a car crash as a two-year-old and have a car crash every day. How's that going to work out?
Yeah.
So, you know, layer upon layer upon layer of adaptation and incomplete response. And then you start to be a different person. You start to be a bit different biology, a different brain. Then you start to have different relationships. And those relationships start to be grooved into what you adapt to think is normal.
Right.
So one of the problems with what we call trauma is that when it happens when we're young or when it happens in a relational setting, so, you know, a car crash is one thing, but if the car crash is your mother every day, then what are you learning about relationships, care, love? And then how's that going to repeat for you as an adult, et cetera, et cetera? So unwinding all of that is potentially impossible. You know, I think anyone can achieve anything in their life if they put their mind to it. If you spent 30 years up a mountain meditating, who knows what you can do? But I think the goal often with treatment is mm-hmm. to help someone get to the next level. Now, you know, for me, where I am in my arc, I would say the biggest challenge, the thing that I would find most difficult, is to have an extraordinarily healthy, personal, intimate relationship. I mean, parenting is, you know, an ongoing struggle with many axes, but to just be able to have a really good relationship with a peer in an intimate relationship, because of course they're the most triggering, I think is the PhD of recovery. And that's what drew me into working with couples and made me interested in being a couples therapist, because actually there's so much you can do for couples with a bit of basic trauma psychoeducation. I noticed that finding recovery from attachment dysfunction, I'll let you know, it's a work in progress. I have no idea if that can be completed or not. Maybe not. And maybe then it's all just about vigilance and guardrails. A bit like, you know, the old-fashioned approach to addiction was the same. It's like, you better see early when the problems are occurring and remember that you want to do something about it, because that's your best chance. But look, that's moved on. People have started to think about reducing reactivity in their bodies, which then reduces the need to be regulated by external agents.
Right.
So maybe it can be done for relationships as well. And I think you have to play the long game. If you want to talk about healing, cure, full recovery, do so. Be ambitious. Be positive. Be thoughtful that that's your goal. but maybe it's a 30, 40, 50 year process. And so what? Yeah. You're going to be alive then anyway. You may as well get better.
So let me ask you, if I can, Benjamin, as far as your work with trauma, what has it taught you about trauma? And I know that's a really broad question, but I just want to give you the opportunity to go wherever you want with that.
Well, it's taught me everything that I think I know about trauma. Mm-hmm. When I was in that desert, I didn't know anything about trauma. I was a psychotherapist who worked in Harley Street and had a column in the Psychologies magazine and thought I was, doing great, big cheese, medium cheese. People would have envied my career in psychotherapy. And I knew nothing about any of these things that I know about now. So is it too cheesy if I mention a book I wrote? Well, I mean, there is a book I wrote called The Invisible Lion, which the title of it comes from this idea that if you're out in the street and you see a guy running down the street, in the typical kind of main street, and there's someone, maybe he's got no shoes on, like his T-shirt's ripped, and he's sort of running and looking over his shoulder wildly and screaming. What do you think? I mean, so I ask people this question, and if I'm lucky, they'll say, he seems crazy. I say, do you cross the street to help him or do you cross the street to avoid him? Then I'd probably avoid that. And then I say, okay, next thing you see coming around the corner that he just emerged from is a fully grown adult lion chasing him. Now what do you see? What do you think? And they're like, oh, he's not crazy. He's running away from a lion. And they're like, and I say, look, if you had a gun and you had to use it, would you maybe help him out? Or would you still be crossing the road? And they're like, yeah, I'd help if I could. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about that story is the man is exactly the same. So he's the identical biochemical machine performing the same acts with the same biochemistry, with the same behavior, the same relationship. Everything about him is identical. The only thing that's different is the context. You can see the threat. So you see the threat response as normal. So you don't think he's crazy and you want to help him. And look, it's a strong statement, but I think almost everything that we think of as a mental illness applies to that paradigm. If you could see the threat that every single person's experienced, and if you could particularly see the threat that's ongoing because it hasn't yet finished in their physiology, then everything about them would make pretty much perfect sense. And you and them would be less judgmental. The diagnosis would be different and the help would be more accurate and effective. That's my view. I did hundreds of initial consultations for people for my clinic. And, people come in and they're like, I'm anxious and et cetera, et cetera. And then eventually you ask them what other problems do you have in your life? And it's not relevant to this, but, I have digestive issues. I have IBS. Mm. Well, maybe it is. Maybe if you think about the subdiaphragmatic effect of the dorsal vagal nerve, maybe it is. Maybe it isn't. I don't know. There are so many things to layer into understanding that a response to threat is physiological. It's biological. It's anatomical. And then when it doesn't complete, it becomes psychological and emotional and relational. And so, there's so many layers to the lattice. But I think what I learned, I was lucky in that I didn't follow one path or another in terms of trauma theory because of what I was doing, both as a patient and as, someone trying to help people in a clinic. I wanted to understand it all and try to understand why so many great people would say things slightly differently. And I think I did in the end. I think I felt like I found a sort of integrative framework for it all. And this is what I would talk to people about. I would say, do you understand that evolution has layered different threat responses into your hardwired biophysiology? So, the earliest response to threat was freeze, and then fight flight came, and then hypervigilance emerged. People could fight or flight quicker. All of these things are adaptive to help species survive. And so they survived. And so they are our ancestors rather than the people that didn't adapt are not. They're all dead. And then you see that. And then you just look at how the body responds to threat. I mean, a lot of this came from people like Peter Levine and Stephen Porges and many others, of course, and their work came from other places. So I just began to see it reasonably simply in terms of I could have not been overwhelmed by something, or I could have been overwhelmed by something and recovered because, an adult caregiver would have come to me and said, wow, that must have been terrifying. Are you okay? And I could have spent 4 hours crying about it. And then it's a memory rather than an experience. And a lot of those things never happen. A lot of weird stuff happened. A lot of peculiar things at boarding school and all kinds of things went on, you know. So I had lots and lots and lots under the hood. But that's what I learned. And then I started to look at how that works in terms of my behavior. Like, you know, what triggers me and what does it mean to be triggered? So let's say I have a lot of this baggage, you know, these unfinished responses to things. Mm-hmm. And I get a trigger. Sometimes I explode. And that's mm-hmm. like an overreaction. But the ultimate explosion of explosion is to no longer react at all. You know, the escalation from fight or flight is to freeze. So I used to say this, like if the triggers are 3 out of 10, the reactions are 9 out of 10, that's overreacting. But if the reaction's 11 out of 10, you're going to see nothing. And that looks like an underreaction. The only healthy reaction is the 3 out of 10, the Goldilocks reaction. You know, it's like the three bears, too hot, too cold, just right.
Yes.
And so we talked a lot about that. And then, you know, then I wrote more about that. And that seemed to really land with people because they could see themselves in that story. And it's no longer that, oh, I'm crazy, or, oh, you know, this is my personality, or, oh, you like your mother, you're so difficult. It's just, yes, that triggers me because it hits my baggage and my baggage has a story and it makes sense. And then if you take two of those systems and put them together, you have something called a relationship, which obviously is now even more complicated because if you take something that could be three ways, like up, down, medium, stick them together, you've got like, I think, six different combinations. And then you see a bunch of different kinds of relationships. So, you know, here's one for an example. When you have an overreactive system in a relationship with an underreactive system, you have a potential for abuse. And, you know, that kind of long-term situation where someone doesn't leave, someone doesn't get out, someone doesn't save themselves, and they keep being, you know, I guess, harmed in some way,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
mild uh-huh. or serious, physical or emotional, whatever it is. And we talk about that a lot, you know, as a society, as a culture, that's become very interesting to talk about. And people talk about yeah. narcissism a lot these days. All sorts of things are talked about. But actually, weirdly, if you just follow this kind of simple arc of here's your evolution, here's your biology, here's the logical conclusion of that, here's what you look like as an individual and what would two people look like, a lot of these things just fall out. It's like you just see them there. And so, you know, two overreacting people together just blow up all the time. They have a volatile mm-hmm. relationship. Those often fail. Two underreactors that just kind of live in different countries. And often those relationships yeah. just kind of drift apart, you know. And then we talk about avoidant and anxious attachment. And you can see that, you know, people who underreact tend to look avoidant and people overreact tend to look anxious. So I think what was interesting is just trying to knock together different pieces of other people's theories about trauma. Kind of created the logical path that took you even back to Bowlby and early attachment theory, things that people had discovered in the universe but hadn't explained, began to be explicable by something as simple as, you know what, you have at least three gears of a response to threat and a limit. Yeah. You know, it's like Einstein's theory. Like, what if you can't travel faster than the speed of light? Then what? And it kind of like the maths that fell out of that ended with E=mc². And I feel it's a bit like that sometimes with trauma work. Like if you just pay attention to the simple body processes and limits, you can see an awful lot of truth about humans that can emerge. So actually that's quite validating and regulating for people. A lot of people say when we get into that discussion, you know, people who come to the clinic, that'll be week one or two, they get all this under the hood. And people say, wow, I feel so much less shame.
Yeah.
I don't feel so judging of myself. I don't feel like such a failure because what happened to me between 0 and 3 or just to anyone at any time can hardly be seen as my responsibility. But what is my responsibility is to kind of get the big picture, understand how it's affected me as an individual, how I'm affecting others because of it, and start to put in some guardrails and change. I mean, you can change behavior by force, you know, by will,
yeah.
a bit. Not always, not all the time. But if you know what you're aiming for and why, you can begin down that path. And there's a nice symbiosis between doing things as if you hadn't been traumatized and recovery. Because if I stop overreacting, well, if I stop manifesting my overreactions as attacking others and start to allow them to become me just explaining that I want to attack others, you know, the simplest shift you can imagine is instead of I hate you, you're a terrible person, just wow, you know, right now I feel like I hate you and you're a terrible person. I must be tremendously triggered. I wonder what's going on.
I think you're talking about ownership with that too, right?
Right. I mean, really kind of just a piece of containment, just bring it back to me, like, you know, 1 meter closer. It's not all about you when I'm freaking out. And these things actually then facilitate health and growth. If you can change your behavior alongside doing some deep inner work, which could be somatic or whatever, that 1-2 punch is tremendously powerful. And that's what I learned in the clinic, because we would do groups, which were all about, you know, why do we hate each other so much? We'll live together. You imagine like 12 traumatized people, so traumatized, yeah, they'd be in a residential facility, trying to like decide who does the washing up. Mm-hmm. It was a shit show, but in a good way. And then the great therapist would lead us through an examination that morning and afternoon. And we started to learn that actually you could have a relationship and not like someone, which was mind blowing mm-hmm. to me. You could feel connected to someone and be in conflict with them, extraordinary. And you could feel no conflict and like someone, but not actually be intimate with them. I mean, so much goes on that's just kind of BS when it comes to people relating to people. So we would be doing our inner work, and then we'd be exploring what it was like to be in relationship with humans. And I think that formula still holds in every level of our service. I mean, we have like outpatient, we have intensive outpatient, we have kind of hospital equivalent, you know, whatever it is, that model still holds. Everybody is working on what it's like to be in the community with each other, and everybody's working on what it's like to be in relation to their own unfinished business. And there's 100 different ways to do that. But so if you think about, like, you know, your question is, what did I learn about trauma? Probably about 1% of what needs to be known about it eventually. Mm-hmm. But hopefully that's close to, I don't know, 50-something percent of what's known about it now. A lot, yeah.
This has been great. I want to ask you, what is your passion right now? Like, as we talk today, what is your passion?
Well, that's a good question. We started our clinic with no full-time staff and in a holiday home that we rented week by week. And it's now a much bigger, more solid, normal enterprise than that. And yet from that day to this day, the passion has not changed in terms of the question is, what does this person need? And are we doing it? And if not, what do we do differently? And what can we learn from experts? What can we learn from patients? What can we learn from clinicians? What can we change? What can we adapt? What can we improve? I mean, you know, you got to be humble. I've been through the ringer. I've been to many things that failed me. Every single person who comes to us as a client has been to things that have failed them. Yeah. If they're lucky, only 2, 3, or 4. I mean, we had a lady who came once, I remember she said she'd been to 10 clinics and 32 doctors over 10 years. She'd had a, you know, she'd been attacked early adulthood. And in 6 weeks of residential treatment, and I think she did EMDR, she had her first unmedicated night's sleep for a decade. So there's something about people, the right solution for the wrong people goes on all over the place all of the time. And then a lot of them come to us. And then for some of them, we're the right solution for the wrong people. So I would never dare to presume that what we do is perfect or is right for everyone. And that humility drives a passion, which drives a process, which I think keeps us all interested. What else am I passionate about? Well, I guess, like, you know, parallel to my personal journey, I'm really interested in helping couples who are manifesting. Yeah. The work I do, it seems to me, I always discover that the problems in relationships are related to individual stuff that's unfinished, right? We talked about unfinished responses to earlier threats.
Right.
They map so well. It's almost inconceivable that we don't learn this stuff as kids. It's just, you know, it's so obvious once you see it. And the reason why I like that work is because actually, if you think about what you can do to change things for broader systems, the big picture, functional families, functional relationships would be a really good place to start. So it seems to me that with a small amount of work, you can do a huge amount of good. And that's different to what we do in a residential clinic, where it's an enormous amount of work that's tremendously transformational for a very small amount of people. So that side of it, I'm proud of, and I hope that it will be as an example to larger healthcare systems that will adopt it. Working with couples, particularly couples in crisis who could go either way, and keeping it on a path that's good for them and their community and their families is really rewarding and helpful. You know, like a lot of people in the world at the moment, I'm interested in where technology takes us as well. And I've been working with Dr. Stephen Porges on a thing which I originally asked him for, which is a nervous systemometer. I mean, imagine if right now you could see on the screen just a simple indicator of each of our nervous systems. Am I going into parasympathetic or sympathetic? Am I in what he would call ventral vagal or sympathetic? And we have this technology and it's about to emerge into the public sphere. So let me see. I would have like a little bar going up when I'm getting more engaged and down when I'm less. The interesting thing about it, we work with a therapist called Deb Dana, who's one of his interpreters.
She has been on the podcast a couple of times.
So you know Deb, and she's amazing and brilliant. And she's so great because you've got like technology people who are saying, okay, but what does it mean? You know, is it up good? Is down bad? And she's like, what it means is that there's a stimulus to ask a question. So if I'm telling you a story and my nervous system moves, it invites you to say, I notice your nervous system moves. What's going on when you tell that story? What do you notice about yourself? And the funniest thing is the guy who's been doing all the coding, who's just not into therapy at all. I don't think he ever needs a day therapy in his life. He's so healthy. Poor guy is now like saturated with all these therapists. So he's the first person who's ever used it. And he would run it on his desktop all day long because he's testing it. And he started to ask himself those questions. And he started to see that when it would move, he'd check in and he'd find something that otherwise he'd have missed. Mm-hmm. And now he can do it without the indicator. So now he's like attuned to his nervous system. And it helps him navigate his life more successfully than before. Isn't that amazing?
It's exciting. It's exciting. What's ahead.
And it's zero interest or need for therapy, probably. You know, in a sense, you could ask yourself, what's it like to have a bionic feedback for you and others on your nervous system as you travel mm-hmm. through life? Probably pretty pretty game-changing if that was reality. Because actually, when we talked earlier about, overreactions, underreactions, those kind of things. And the invisible lion, like making the invisible lion visible. Changes the game. It changes that street. It changes the fear that person induces in others, and it changes the help that comes his way. So, there's a world where you can imagine technology having a hand in making the invisible visible. And we're doing a small piece of work on that, a thing called televagal, which is, because Stephen invented a camera. I went to him and I said, can you like give me a thing so in group we can show each other who's triggered and who's not? Can we invent it together? He's like, I already invented it. It's fine. It's a camera. It's not a wearable. You can just point a camera at someone and they'll tell you their nervous system. I was like, how is that possible? I mean, the man's a genius. It's amazing. People know him for his polyvagal work, but he's actually a brilliant engineer as well.
So Benjamin,
those are the things that I'm interested in. I'm interested in helping the people that need the most help, where you can pull the lever for maximum response to the help you're putting in, which I think is relational and societal. And I'm also interested in where technology takes us.
So this has been wonderful. And I want to thank you for joining me. Hope we can do this again. And if people are interested and want to explore more of your work, where can we direct them, Benjamin?
Well, I guess there's three things we've kind of talked about, which have three different websites, which may be too much of a mouthful. But there's me, benjaminfry.co.uk. There's chironclinics.com, which is the clinics. And then there's televagal.com, which is the technology. If you're interested in my book, that's on benjaminfry.co.uk. Or you could even go to theinvisiblelion.com. But it gets very convoluted.
Excellent.
And you know what? I just like to say, and don't do this to sell books. Most... like if you really needed to know what you need to know, you can get it for free on the website. You can get it for free on theinvisiblelion.com. Read all the blogs, download the workbooks, whatever you like. For me, it's about getting the psychoeducation into the hands of people that will then, a lot of people with that, just with a book, can kind of teach themselves enough to make enough difference, to make a difference to others. And that's what I really care about.
I really appreciate your work. I appreciate you. And I want to thank you for this time together.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.